Wow, thanks for being here tonight. I'm delighted to be with you again, and I want to tell you how much I've enjoyed the opportunity this week to be with the group here and to engage in this series of lessons. My first time to be in College Station. It's been a great week for me. I've been greatly encouraged by you, and I hope that our time together has been pleasing to God. I hope it has been profitable for you. I have some things I want to say to you by way of summary. If you will indulge me at the end of, after we sing the invitation song tonight, if you'll give me just a moment at the end of the service just to say a couple of things to you on a personal nature, I would like to get started into the lesson right now. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 3 tonight, and I would just remind you tonight, If you think the Romans invented emperor worship, you can just think again. Men have had big egos for a long, long time, and that was certainly the case during the days of Nebuchadnezzar. It was certainly the case during the time that Daniel and his three Hebrew friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were with him there in Babylon, in the palace. And you may remember that as chapter 2 closes, the king is, he's excited because Daniel had interpreted the dream, and oh, he's praising God, and he's just full of all kinds of good words for God. Let me tell you something, save the words if you're not going to give God your heart and your life. Because after he gets through saying all those great things, oh, the God of Daniel is the true God, he's the living God, everybody ought to praise this. In chapter 3, he's erecting a statue to himself so that everyone can bow down and worship the golden image when they hear the sound of the instruments. And you remember that this was, in fact, an act of tribute and honor and devotion and commitment to him. It was a statement of loyalty. It was a pledge of allegiance to him as God, our emperor. Well, when he told them to set up on the plain of Dura this great image, in chapter 3 of Daniel, there were the three Hebrew friends of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who had been renamed Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They, being of Hebrew descent, though they were far from home, there were certain things that they carried in their heart that had been stamped into their very being, into their character. It was part of them. It defined them. It was who they were. And when they said, bow down to this image, I'll tell you, those boys, they hadn't been home for a long time, hadn't seen mom, hadn't seen dad, hadn't seen their grandparents, had not been to temple worship, had not seen the priest. But I'll tell you, those boys learned from the earliest time they could remember. We are the children of Abraham. There are some things we don't do. And one of the things we don't do is bow down and worship an image. And I'm going to remind parents again tonight of what a gift it is for your children. If by the time they leave your home, voluntarily, or if they're expatriated by a bunch of Babylonian thugs who show up and force them away. What a gift you give your children if, when they leave home, they have a clear understanding of who they are. And so these three boys did not bow down to the image, as you may well imagine. And so in Daniel chapter 3, the text says, therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and they brought accusation against the Jews. And they answered and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. I'll just pause and say, kissing up was not invented by our own political system. It's been around for a long time. And they were starting out their discourse with the king by praising him and lauding him and honoring him. They wanted to use him for their own benefit. And verse 10 says, "Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, all kinds of music, will fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship, the same shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." What are they doing? They're starting out by saying to the king, "Oh, king, you are the man. You're the great one. We love you. Live forever." "Oh, that's good. Go ahead. Say more." And then they say to the king in verse 10, "Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every time..." Now, what were they saying? They were saying to the king, "Now, king, you said..." Your children ever do that to you? "Now, dad, you said..." You know, when your children start feeding your words back to you, this isn't going to end well, whatever's about to happen. Not going to... "You said..." This is what you said. "That when those musical instruments play, everybody bows down and they pledge their allegiance to you. And if they don't do this, they're going to be thrown into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. You said that. You issued the decree. Remember that." And then they said in verse 12, "There are certain Jews whom thou hast appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon." Let me tell you, in case you didn't get it, there's a little bit of national and ethnic jealousy and pride, and a little bit of anger here. That these proud Chaldeans, they were the citizens of Babylon. And this king, for whatever reason, had set these certain... You can almost hear the disgust in their voice. "These certain Jews." Do you think anti-Semitism was just invented? No way. Let me tell you, God's people haven't been the heroes for a long, long time. And they weren't in biblical times. They were hated by the nations around them. And the Chaldeans now especially hate them because they are living in their own country, in the capital city of their own province. And there are these certain Jews who have been given positions, cabinet level, government job, positions of authority over them. And they are natural born citizens belonging here. They were born into this nation. What was this king thing? "There are certain Jews that you have set over the affairs of this province. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They do not serve thy gods, nor will they worship the golden image that thou hast set up." What's going on here? They're saying to the king, "Look, you brought these Jews..." They almost hold their nose when they say, "You brought these Jews in here and you set them up over us. Over us. What you have done for them is unthinkable, that you would do that for someone, but especially for a Jew, you have done that." Oh, wow. I mean, they are the lowest of the low, and you gave them something like this. They ought to be worshiping you and kissing you forever. "You established the decree that everyone, when the musical instruments play, are going to bow down and pay homage to you and honor you and acknowledge you. You have done so much for them. You have, in fact, pushed us aside and you have set them over us And now, look, this is the way they repay you. This is how they respond after all you have done for them. You know the principle really well, don't you? Somebody does something really magnanimous for you. And it's just natural. You feel indebted to them. You feel a sense of obligation to them. You remember Jesus said, Do you think I came to bring peace to the earth? I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. I came to set a man at variance against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are going to be those of his own household. And Jesus went on to say, and whoever honors his father, mother, son, or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, is not ready for the kingdom. And I'm telling you, Jesus was saying this to his disciples because Jesus understood 2,000 years ago that we feel a tremendous sense of obligation and debt to those who have done so much for us. Our benefactors. There's a remarkable passage in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Wonderful sermon that we don't have time to study tonight. It's found in this text. And it has to do with Moses and the faith of Moses. But it says, by faith, Moses, by faith, Moses, when he was born, well, it starts off with his parents, actually. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a goodly child. He was a beautiful child. And they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, let me stop right here. I just have to point this out to you. When he was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, you remember how old Moses was when this transition took place? When he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? 40 years old when he finally figured out who he was. That he was an Israelite. That these were his people that were being subjugated to slavery. And that these were his people who were being mistreated by the Egyptians. But the text says, by faith Moses, when he was grown up, let me just make one other observation. Moses was 40 years old. Two things I want to say about that. Moses, when he finally grew up, he was 40 years old. It takes boys longer than it takes girls. I will tell you this. If you have a child who is still figuring out who they are, take a little courage. Moses was 40 years old before he got it figured out. The second thing I want to say to you is this. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, I want to tell you something. When Moses was born, you think you were born at an inopportune time? Why did I have to be born right now? You ever heard that? I didn't ask for this. Well, big boy, you think me and your mom ordered you out of a catalog? Moses. When he was born, there was a death sentence issued for male Hebrew children. By all legal rights, he should have been dead. But his parents, they saw he was a goodly child. They hid him. They were not afraid of the king's commandment. Interesting. We don't have time to do this, but look down at verse 27. Draw yourself a little arrow from verse 23 in the margin down to verse 27. By faith, Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Oh, where do you think he got that? Because his mom and daddy had a whole lot of that. And his mama came to the palace and was his nursemaid. And his mama taught him who he was. And he never forgot it. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I have to get back on track. The point I'm making is this. Pharaoh's daughter found him. I mean, his parents are hiding him so the king won't have him killed. The edict of the king is that he die. And who finds him? The daughter of the king. Wouldn't you know? I mean, what's your luck? Somebody's going to come down to the river and fight. It had to be the daughter of the king. And instead of that being the worst thing in the world that could have happened to him, it was the best thing in the world because she took him. She saved his life. And she took him back to the palace and he was raised as the prince of Egypt. He had wealth. He had power. He had servants. He had education. He had fine clothes. He had the royal chariot. He had everything. Don't you think it crossed his mind more than once as he was growing up? His mama was his nursemaid. She was teaching him who he was. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. She was teaching him about his heritage. And yet, this woman had saved his life, had made him the prince. He was living in the palace. He was educated by the best. He had it all thanks to her. Let me tell you something, folks. When he was 40 years old, he had to make a decision that was going to be a tremendous disappointment to that woman. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Don't ever underestimate how hard it is to disappoint the people who have been your benefactors. It was hard. That's what the Chaldeans are saying to Nebuchadnezzar. Look what you did for these Jews. There are certain Jews whom thou hast appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. And look how they're treating you now. They owe you so much. They were nothing. They were the scum of the earth. And you've made them powerful and rich. And you've set them over us and they had everything. And look how they're treating you now. Can you believe it? And the text says he did believe it. Because, why? Because he was in a rage. Verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and in his fury, he commanded them to come, to bring them before him so that he could talk to them. I want to say something to you right now. There are two things that Nebuchadnezzar did, and we need to learn this lesson. First of all, even though he had been told something that absolutely infuriated him. You know what they said? You know what they did? Somebody comes up and says, David, you know what they said about your sermon? Do you know what so-and-so sent in an email to somebody else about your sermon? I heard them say, he sent this text message and he said... Have you ever been that? You ever been there? Ever heard that? Has somebody ever come and told you what somebody else said, what somebody else did? It wasn't very flattering. Nebuchadnezzar believed it. He was in a rage and a fury. But I'm telling you, even in His rage and fury, two things you need to pay attention to. Number one, He said, I want to talk to those men myself, face to face, and I want to hear it from their mouth. Yeah, He had been told. Yes, He did believe it. But He still wanted to establish the fact. And they come in. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it on purpose that you did this, Shadrach, Meshach? Is it on purpose? Listen to me. He's a Babylonian king. They are Hebrew nobodies. And he's saying to them, I want to get this straight now. What? Is there some misunderstanding? Did you do this on purpose? He's trying to understand the truth of the situation. He said, if you will just tell me right now that the next time you hear those musical instruments play, that you're going to fall down and worship the image that I have set up, well. Do you understand what he said? He said, first of all, I want to get the facts straight. I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. I want to talk to the person involved. Sounds kind of like Matthew 18, doesn't it? I want to talk to the person involved. And I want to ask him face to face, has there been some misunderstanding or is this what happened? Even if this is what happened, listen, Nebuchadnezzar said, I'll tell you what. You just tell me that the next time you're going to bow down and worship the image, I'm willing to forgive and forget, and we'll go on. Wow. I want to ask you something. When you've had your delicate little feelings stepped on, and somebody has been unkind to you, and your ego is bruised, and I'm sitting there in my corner nursing my little wounds and blessing my little heart for what's happened to myself that somebody did. I have to ask myself, am I willing to get the facts from the person involved? I better be, folks. Brethren, we better be. And secondly, even if my worst suspicion is proven to be true, am I willing to offer forgiveness? I'm telling you, Nebuchadnezzar did both. Shame on us if we're not able to do it. And a pagan Babylonian king was able to offer it. And so, he said, you just tell me that and we'll forget it, okay? But, he said, let's be clear about this, boys. I don't want you to leave here with any misunderstanding today. If you do not bow down and worship that image, you are going into the fire. No question, no exception. You're going into the furnace. And this is where he crossed the line. And he said, and who is the God? Who is the God who can stop this? Who's the God who can deliver you from my hand? Wow. You talk about a guy who's full of himself. He was. And who is the God who can deliver you? Now, let me tell you something, folks. You don't know, and I don't know, what kinds of challenges our children are going to face when they leave us. I'm telling you, the mama and daddy of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, I suspect they never had any idea what their boys were going to have to face in life. It's not just that I don't know what my children are going to have to face. I don't even know what I'm going to have to face tomorrow. Is there anybody here whose life has turned out just exactly the way you thought it would? I don't think so. Because life doesn't work that way. It's just not. But these boys were standing there, and the most powerful man in the world is telling them, you bow down and worship me, or you're going into the fire. And if you think you're going to pray to some deity, and some deity's going to, who's the God who's going to deliver? And right there, through all of this rage and fury, these boys had not said a word. But when he brought their God into this discussion, stop! Stop right there! That changed everything. He could talk about them. He could scream at them. He could yell at them. He could threaten them. He could throw them in the fire. But when he said, who is the God who is able to deliver you from my... Whoa! They could not stand there and stay silent any longer. And they said, wait just a minute. If it be so, O King, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And don't you ever forget that. Our God is able. You ask us, who is the God who is able? Our God is able. Don't ever say that about our God. And He will deliver us from your hand, O King. But you need to know something. Whether He delivers us from the fire or not, we're not going to serve your gods. And we're not going to worship the image that you set up. Wow. I'm saying to you, ladies and gentlemen, that there comes a time to get jealous for God. These boys, they were being maligned. They were being slandered. They were being mistreated. They were being threatened. They were being intimidated. They weren't saying a word. But when Nebuchadnezzar brought their God into this discussion and belittled their God, they found their voice. And they found their backbone. And they stepped forward and they said clearly and unequivocally, our God is able. Don't ever forget that. And furthermore, whether you throw us in the fire or not, we don't worship images. And we don't bow down to pagan gods. There's nothing to discuss. Yeah, but I'm going to throw you in the fire. It doesn't matter. You're going to put us in a rocket and shoot us to the moon? It doesn't matter. Well, come here, let's discuss that. There's nothing to discuss. We don't do that. Period. There's some things, ladies and gentlemen, that for Christians ought not to be points of discussion. Christians tell the truth. Period. Jesus said, if you're going to open your mouth, you're going to be my disciple. Let me tell you something about the kingdom of God. In the kingdom, my disciples, when they say yes, it means yes, brother, and you can take it to the bank. And when they say no, it means no, and you can count on it. Because my disciples tell the truth. I'm saying to you that there's some things for us that just ought to be fundamental. And it was so for these three Hebrew boys. Now, I want to remind you of something, and then I want to close with just five very quick points about the importance of spiritual camaraderie. It would be a difficult thing to stand in front of a person who held power over you, even the power of life and death. It would be a very difficult thing to stand in His presence as He's screaming and yelling in a rage and a fury. It would be difficult to stand there. And maintain a position, a truth that He was repudiating. But I will tell you this. What a blessing for Hananiah, Shadrach. What a blessing that he had Meshach, Abednego standing there with him. What a blessing. I don't know if you've ever thought about it or not, but I think you know that God knew, ladies and gentlemen. Brothers and sisters, God knew we needed each other. And listen to me. And not just a little bit. We need each other badly. Truly. And sincerely. There is something to be said for the strength that is derived from spiritual camaraderie in the kingdom. And I'm telling you tonight, listen, look around you tonight. If you see, even in your presence this evening, a man, a woman, a brother or a sister who is a genuine spiritual comrade, a soulmate in your life, before you pillow your head tonight, you get on your knees and thank God for that person. What a blessing to have spiritual comrades in this life. I'll tell you what they'll do for us. If you have the right kind of friends, if you have some true spiritual friends in your life, they'll help you respond wisely when it's not easy to. You know, there are times in life when we don't do our best thinking. You know what I'm saying? There are times in life when we're just not apt to give our best response. Somebody comes along and just slaps you upside the head with a 2x4, and now you're about to say something. Probably that's not going to be your finest moment. Probably if you speak quickly and forthrightly, you're not going to speak very well. I'm telling you, one of the things that spiritual friends do is they help us mind our tongue and shut our mouth when we need to back up and take a deep breath and count to 10 or 20 before we respond to a situation. I'll tell you what a spiritual friend will do. When he sees you about to respond inappropriately, a spiritual friend is going to step in your way and make you back up. And he's going to talk to you about what you're about to say and about the importance of the consequences of your words. Be careful and let your friends help you not make impulsive mistakes when you are emotional. Secondly, spiritual friends call us out when we're getting out of line. That's just what they do. They are the very... You remember Proverbs chapter 27, verses 5 and 6? The writer of Proverbs says, "The kisses of an enemy are profuse, but faithful are the wounds of a friend. Here's somebody, he's walking along, he's headed for a cliff, he's about to step off the edge of a cliff. His enemies are watching him, everybody's watching him. He's about to take the leap to disaster. And he said, how am I doing? How's it going? How am I looking? You know what his enemies are going to say? Oh man, looking good! Looking good, brother! Yes, sir! Everything's great! Am I doing well? Oh, great! You are doing great! Kiss up. The kisses of an enemy are profuse. They're lies. What's your friend going to do? He sees you headed in the wrong direction. You're about to go off that proverbial cliff. You're about to make the mistake of your life. You are about to say something, to do something, to commit to something that is going to change your life forever. I'll tell you what your spiritual friend's going to do. He is going to get in your face. He is going to call you out. He is going to say to you what nobody else wants to say. You've got egg all over your face. Are you kidding me? You need to back up. You need to go clean up. You need to take a good look at yourself. Walking around with egg all over your face, your enemy. Hey, looking good, looking good. Everybody's laughing. Your friend doesn't want everybody laughing at you. Your friend doesn't want you doing anything stupid. Your friend does not want you destroying your soul. Your enemies may not care if you are about to destroy your life, if you're about to bring consequences to yourself that are going to be painful and difficult for years to come. Your enemies don't care about that, but I'll tell you what, if you have true spiritual friends in your life, they will get in your face about that. And if it means making you mad, if it means risking the friendship for a moment of time, if it means that you're not going to like them during this moment, so be it. But I'll tell you, a spiritual friend is more interested in helping you get to heaven than in having your good pleasure for the evening. You know, I'm saying to you, the fact that Hananiah had Mishael and Azariah beside him, it didn't make the fire less hot. It wasn't going to make the fire less hot. But can you imagine what's going to happen? They're standing there defending the integrity and the honor of their God. Can you imagine if one of those boys had said, well, you know, we can just kind of bend our knees just a little. We don't have to bow all the way down. And, you know, I mean, what good are we going to be if we're dead? If one of those guys is what do you think those other two guys? They would have been all over him. What are you thinking? What are you doing? Are you crazy? I'll tell you what spiritual friends do for us, folks. When our brain cells shut down for a moment and we're following passions and desires and not reason and spirituality, our spiritual friends will get in our face and they will call us out and they will insist that we get back in line and do what we ought to do. They will tell us to rearrange our priorities, and if they see us little by little compromise here, little compromise there, another compromise here, they're going to call us out. They see us begin to put material things and earthly things and ungodly things ahead of things that really matter, they're going to be all over us about that. That's why God wanted us to consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. God wanted us to be together. He wanted us to help each other, encourage one another. We got that provoke part. We quote that, you know, God wants us to consider one another and provoke. Well, buddy, we got that down. But the text says provoke unto love and good works. Encouraging each other in this way. I'll tell you what spiritual comrades do. They give us courage. They don't make the fire less hot, but they give us courage to face the fire. I'm going to tell you something that's just true. When I'm with you, and you're standing tall spiritually, and you are saying things that honor God, and you are doing things that honor God, I'm just telling you the truth. When I'm with you, and you're saying the things that honor God, and you're doing the things that honor God, it helps me say the right thing. And it gives me courage to do the right thing. And I'll tell you something. When a boy is dating a girl, and that girl helps him to be the man that God wants him to be. It's easier for him to be that kind of man. And when a girl is dating a boy and the same thing, he is being a godly man, it helps her to be a godly woman. Spiritual comrades give us courage to do the right thing. And finally, let me just say to you, spiritual comrades stick with us all the way to the end, through the sunshine and the rain. I'll tell you something about brothers. Brothers stick together. Writer of Proverbs said, there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother, a physical brother. There is. Brothers stick together. Did you have siblings when you were growing up? I had three sisters, two brothers. We were three boys, three girls. Neurotic parents. But anyway, it was fun at our house. We were evenly matched. And I'll tell you what brothers do. We grow up together and we eat together and sleep together and play together and work together and fuss and fight together. And we do all kinds of things together. But let me tell you, if somebody is in trouble, you better never doubt this. Brothers stick together. They stick together. Don't even know what the problem is yet, but I can tell you this, when the problem comes, those two brothers are going to be just like that. If one of them has a problem, the other one has the problem. They stick together. I want to tell you, there's a story that came out of World War II. It's a story about two boys that grew up in the Midwest together. They lived across the street from each other, played ball together as they were growing up in elementary school, junior high school. They did the little league stuff. They played football together. They were on the same teams together in that little town. Their parents knew each other. They did everything together. Went down and registered for the draft together. They were drafted at the same time. Went to boot camp together. They were in the same troops as they were deployed overseas. And they were in the midst of the battle in World War II, and their sergeant was with them, and it was a very, very difficult assault that day on the field. These two boys had been together all of their life. And one of the boys was sent out onto the field with a battalion of soldiers, the other one in the foxhole with his sergeant. And they were watching in the heat of the battle, and he saw his friend go down on the field. The gunfire was intense. And he moaned out loud when he saw his friend go down. And his sergeant turned and looked at him, and he knew exactly that look. And he pointed his finger in that young boy's face, and he said, "Don't even think about it. You stick your head up out of this hole and they're going to blow you into a million pieces." In just a moment, the sergeant was distracted with something else. That boy was out of that foxhole and across that field. 3 minutes later, he fell back into the foxhole with the corpse of his friend in his arms. Sergeant is just... he's just aghast at what he's looking at. The boy was bleeding profusely. He had been shot several times. And the sergeant says to him, "Why did you do that? Look at you! Why did you do that? You've just destroyed yourself. It was of no use. It was of no value. It was for nothing. I told you not to go. Why did you go? It wasn't worth it." And the boy looked up at his sergeant and he said, "Oh yes, it was." He said, "As soon as I got there on the field and I put my hands underneath his head and I was picking him up, he opened his eyes. And the last thing he said to me was this: I knew you would come for me." I want to tell you something, folks. Sometimes in this spiritual warfare of life, Satan's going to take his best shot at us. And we may be wounded and bloodied face down on the field. I want to ask you something. If that's you, spiritually, if that's you who's taken such a hit, can you right now, in your heart of hearts, name, if you are Hananiah, can you name right now your Mishael and Azariah that you know they're going to come for you? And I'm saying to you tonight, if you have spiritual comrades in your life like that, you are among all people most blessed. God help us to be that kind of comrade to our friends in need. Your spiritual camaraderie has been wonderful for me this week, and I thank you for it. As we extend the invitation, I